Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Tuesday, October 17, 2023. The House takes a vote on electing a new speaker to replace the ousted speaker, Kevin McCarthy, and no candidate gets the necessary majority of members casting votes to be elected. The Republican conference nominee, Jim Jordan, could afford to have three Republican votes for another candidate. 20 voted for other candidates. President Joe Biden visiting Israel as a show of support for that country as it responds to Hamas's deadly attacks just over a week ago, and also reports say to emphasize the need to get humanitarian aid into Gaza, which is controlled by Hamas, currently the target of an air barrage by Israel and may soon be the subject of a massive ground assault. We'll have the latest on a U.S. military aid package that Congress will soon take up for Israel. Republican and Democratic House and Senate leaders attend a rally in support of Israel at the historic Sixth I Synagogue in Washington, D.C. Democratic Congresswoman Cori Bush posts a video in support of her resolution calling for a ceasefire by both Hamas and Israel. And U.S. Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett expresses support for the Supreme Court's adopting an ethics code. This from Fox News. Judiciary Committee Chair Jim Jordan, Republican of Ohio, lost the first round vote to be House Speaker on Tuesday after 20 Republicans joined all Democrats to shoot him down. Seven Republicans voted for Majority Leader Steve Scalise, who was the previous Speaker designate before being forced to withdraw due to mounting opposition. Six Republican lawmakers voted for ousted ex-Speaker Kevin McCarthy, and three moderate New York Republicans voted for former Republican Congressman Lee Zeldin. Additional votes were cast for the House Rules Committee Chair Tom Cole, the Majority Whip Tom Emmer, Congressman Mike Garcia of California, and Congressman Thomas Massey of Kentucky. That from Fox News. Here's how it played out on the House floor. The session opened with a prayer about the Speaker's election from the House Chaplain, Margaret Kibben.
And remind us that though we are many, we are members of one another. Out of many may one emerge, one common purpose which we each share, to serve this nation wisely, with purpose and compassion, with enthusiasm and discernment, with strength and with prudence, with determination and with humility, always in service to you and devoted to each other in love.
The House Chaplain, Margaret Gern Kibben, retired Rear Admiral, at today's House session. And then with Speaker Pro Tem Patrick McHenry, Republican from North Carolina, presiding, there was a call for nominations for Speaker. And there were two, Republican Jim Jordan of Ohio and Democrat Hakeem Jeffries of New York, the current minority leader, each of whom received his party's nomination in conference and caucus meetings earlier. Congresswoman Elise Stefanik, Republican of New York, the conference chair, nominated Jim Jordan.
Our friend and colleague Jim Jordan is a patriot. He is an America First warrior who wins the toughest of fights, going after corruption and delivering accountability at the highest levels of government on behalf of we, the people. Jim is the voice of the American people who have felt voiceless for far too long. Whether as judiciary chair, conservative leader, or representative for his constituents in West Central Ohio, whether on the wrestling mat or in the committee room, Jim Jordan is strategic, scrappy, tough, and principled. He is a mentor, a worker, and above all, he is a fighter. And the American people know, we know, that Jim Jordan is a winner on behalf of the American people. Almost 10 years ago, many of us sat with our colleague Jim Jordan in this very chamber when Prime Minister Netanyahu delivered his historic joint address, which some of our colleagues across the aisle shamefully boycotted. Bibi pointed out that in this very chamber, we serve under the watchful gaze of Moses. He said, quote, "Overlooking all of us in this chamber is the image of Moses. And before the people of Israel entered the land of Israel, Moses gave us a message that has steeled our resolve for thousands of years. Be strong and resolute, neither fear nor dread them." He went on to say, "My friends, may Israel and America always stand together, strong and resolute. May we neither fear nor dread the challenges ahead. May we face the future with confidence, strength, and hope." End quote. On behalf of the American people, let's face the future with confidence, strength, and hope. Let's elect Jim Jordan, our Speaker of the People's House, for such a time as this. And I yield back.
Congresswoman Elise Stefanik, Republican from New York, the House Republican Conference Chair, on the floor nominating Congressman Jim Jordan for Speaker. Congressman Pete Aguilar, Democrat from California, the Democratic Caucus Chair, nominated the current Democratic leader, Hakeem Jeffries of New York, for Speaker.
A vote today to make the architect of a nationwide abortion ban, a vocal election denier, and an insurrection insider to the Speaker of this House would be a terrible message to the country and our allies. Mr. Speaker, it would send an even more troubling message to our enemies that the very people who would seek to undermine democracy are rewarded with positions of immense power. We are talking about someone who has spent his entire career trying to hold our country back, putting our national security in danger, attempting government shutdown after government shutdown, wasting taxpayer dollars on baseless investigations with dead ends, authoring the very bill that would ban abortion nationwide without exceptions, and inciting violence on this chamber. Even leaders of his own party have called him a legislative terrorist. He once said, quote, "I didn't come to Congress to make more laws." His words speak for themselves. When New Yorkers recovering from Hurricane Sandy needed Congress to act, he said no. When wildfires ravaged the West, destroying homes and businesses, and those residents needed disaster assistance, he said no. When the Mississippi River floods devastated the South and communities across state lines needed Congress to act, he said no. When our veterans were suffering from disease and dying as a result of their service to our country, and Congress passed a bipartisan solution, he said no. When our ally in Ukraine looked to Congress for additional support to help defeat Putin, he said no. And just before Hamas's brutal terrorist attack on Israel, he said no to fully funding military aid for our ally. This body is debating elevating a speaker nominee who has not passed a single bill in 16 years. These are not the actions of someone interested in governing or bettering the lives of everyday Americans. This is nothing less than the rejection of the oath that we swore to uphold as duly elected members of this body. But on this side of the aisle and throughout this chamber, I'm convinced our oath still matters. To fulfill our obligations to the American people, we have no choice today but to vote for a leader of both character and conviction. When the Congress first began, we proudly stood next to him as our leader and made a promise to every American. House Democrats would work to find common ground on the issues that matter most to the American people whenever possible. That we would stand up to extremism whenever necessary. Only Hakeem Jeffries can be trusted to keep his word. Only Hakeem Jeffries can lead us out of the chaos and towards a path of governance. It brings me immense pride to nominate our friend, the Democratic leader, Hakeem Jeffries, as Speaker.
Congressman Pete Aguilar, Democrat from California, the caucus chair, speaking for, in favor of Hakeem Jeffries to be Speaker, and against the Republican nominee, Jim Jordan. After the nominations, there was a roll call vote by the House reading clerk of each member of Congress's name. The member stood and said by last name who she or he would vote for. When that was over, the House reading clerk and the four House members who were appointed tellers, two Democrats and two Republicans, made sure all their vote totals matched. And then the Speaker pro tem, Patrick McHenry, in the Speaker's chair, announced the result.
The tellers agree in their tallies that the total number of votes cast is 432, of which the Honorable Jim Jordan of the state of Ohio has received 200 votes. The Honorable Hakeem Jeffries of the state of New York has received 212 votes. The Honorable Kevin McCarthy of the State of California has received 6 votes. Lee Zeldin of the State of New York has received 3. The Honorable Steve Scalise of the State of Louisiana has received 7. The Honorable Mike Garcia of the State of California has received 1. The Honorable Tom Emmer of the State of Minnesota has received 1. The Honorable Tom Cole of the State of Oklahoma has received 1. The Honorable Thomas Massey of the State of Kentucky has received 1. No person having received a majority of the whole number of votes cast by surname, a speaker has not been elected. Pursuant to Clause 12A of Rule 1, the chair declares the House in recess subject to the call of the chair.
Speaker pro tem Patrick McHenry in the speaker's chair today. NBC News points out this round of votes marks the 16th time in history that the U.S. House has needed multiple ballots to elect a speaker. We spoke to NBC News senior congressional reporter Scott Wong about what may happen next.
You were reading some of the tweets from Olivia Beavers and myself. Very similar reporting. I just spoke to a Jim Jordan backer downstairs just a few minutes ago who said that they know personally 5 to 6 members, Republicans, who had just cast their ballot for Jim Jordan, but on the second ballot now will vote for somebody else. That does not bode well for Jim Jordan. He wants to shrink the number of defectors. Instead, there's a possibility we could see the number of defections, which stands now at 20, really start to grow and balloon. And at that point, it really would be over for Jim Jordan. Perhaps that is a reason why, instead of going right to the second ballot, that he is regrouping, huddling with his team, his whip operation. We saw him conferring with former Speaker Kevin McCarthy in the moments after the gavel slammed down. But the Republican Party right now is really in a state of disarray, and a lot of lawmakers are scratching their head as to what the next step is at this point, Greta.
Why would those 5 to 6 switch from yes to no?
Well, I think the reasoning would be Jim Jordan is the party's nominee at this point, at this moment in time for that first ballot. But his opponents in voting against him, 20 defectors, demonstrated that Jim Jordan is far away from being able to secure those 217 votes that he needs. He fell, in fact, 17 votes short, only getting 200 votes today. And so the thinking from, I think, some of these individuals is that, well, Jim Jordan can't get 217, just like Steve Scalise could not get 217. Now we have to move to a plan C or D. Or another scenario would be to leave Speaker McHenry, the Speaker pro tem, in that position, grant him a few more powers to enable legislating to start happening again. Because remember, Greta, we've been 2 weeks now without an official elected Speaker of the House. And in that time, no legislating has occurred on the House floor at a time when, we are now exactly 1 month away from the next government shutdown, when there are demands for additional Ukraine aid and additional aid for the war in Israel. And so there are some really heavy issues that are hanging above the Capitol right now, and we have not seen any sort of activity for the better part of 2 weeks.
Where are the key players at this moment?
Well, it is unclear. I think they are huddling in their respective offices. You have to imagine the leadership is trying to figure out a path forward, if there is a path forward for Jim Jordan. I was with lawmakers as they were walking back to their offices, the rank and file lawmakers. So they are awaiting word as to the next step. It is possible we could see additional votes later this afternoon, but we are sort of in a holding pattern, a wait and see mode, as Jordan figures out what his next play is. remember, there are also others that are waiting in the wings. I wrote on Friday a story about Mike Johnson, who is a member of leadership, who has signaled that he is ready to jump into the speaker's race should Jordan not be able to secure the 217 votes that he needs. There are others that are believed to be raring to go. Tom Emmer, the majority whip, as well as some other names. And so we are sort of in a state of chaos and disarray, as we have been for the last 2 weeks, and nothing really has changed.
NBC News senior congressional reporter Scott Wong interviewed by C-SPAN after the first House floor vote for Speaker today, and no member getting a majority of those voting in order to be elected. Some members of Congress spoke to reporters on the steps of the U.S. Capitol building after this vote.
Constituents believe that we're dysfunctional, and now we're showing that we're dysfunctional.
Republican Dan Muser of Pennsylvania.
We need to get back in there. I know Jim's going to be working at it. I know Kevin's going to be working at it. I know Steve just voted for Jim Jordan. Most of the leadership did. Most of the committee chairs did. And, you know, we got some good friends of mine that are not on board at this point. They're voting for Lee Zeldin. So we got to, you know, we got to wake up and stop this nonsense. There's real serious work to be done.
But those others would say they didn't start the nonsense, of course.
So what? Okay. Right? Think about it, right? Okay, so that was done. There were eight that created all kinds of destruction. Why are we going to prolong these setbacks? You know, I had a couple say that to me now. We didn't start this. I mean, I don't know. I haven't heard that since, you know, the playground.
Big picture, do you expect Jordan is going to go back to the floor now, or do you think that you guys need to have a conference meeting?
We'll see. We'll see what the math says, right? We'll see what the progress can be made over the next couple of hours. I mean, I just had some brief discussions, but pretty direct and relatively strong with a couple of members. And maybe they come around. I mean, you know, we got to understand, we got to operate as a team, because if we don't, we will lose everything and continue the disarray and lose appropriations and you know, just continue to muddle through and have things get worse. So
what do you make of the number?
We got to stop making good the enemy of perfect.
There were seven appropriators who voted against Jim Jordan.
Yeah.
What did you make of that?
Well, you know, Jim's been anti-earmarks. Look, I get earmarks. They don't increase the size of our budget. We just allocate it where we have discretion over it. So I think some of them are going back 5, 6, 10 years on Jim Jordan. They're not dealing with the Jim Jordan of today. And I've been here for almost 5 years now. The Jim Jordan I've dealt with is reasonable, is on the side of the right thing, and doesn't make good the enemy of perfect.
Thank you.
So he's the man. We gotta get past this.
Were you surprised by 20 no votes though?
Not really. That's kind of where I heard it was going to be. So if we can whittle it down to 10 in a hurry and then get there. So I think it's more likely we do than we don't. But on the same note, we got to be prepared to what's next.
Congressman Dan Muser, Republican from Pennsylvania, with reporters on the steps of the U.S. Capitol after that first vote on the House floor on electing the speaker. And as you heard from the question, Congressman Jim Jordan, Republican from Ohio, nominated by the Republican conference, came up 20 votes short, 20 votes that from his conference that he did not get. He could only afford to lose three. Also speaking with reporters, Congressman Chip Roy, Republican from Texas.
Are you surprised to see 20 holdouts on Mr. Jordan?
Well, I mean, the way I look at it is Jim got 200 votes for Speaker of the House. And if you'd asked somebody that about 4 years ago, people would have looked at you and laughed. I think at the end of the day, we're in a position where now people can, I mean, they're out there. Their constituents will let them know whether they're for them or against them. That's true for all of us. We all have to, you know, look at our constituents in the eye and tell them why we do something. So we'll see what happens over the course of the day. I expect we'll probably go back to the well at some point today.
Do you think that some of those folks will flip though before the day's out?
I'm not very, you know, I don't enjoy being in the prediction business. What I know is we all have to go listen to our constituents, so we'll see what happens.
Do you expect him to offer anything to folks? Do you think this is a policy or base or rules-based disagreement here?
You'd have to talk to Jim about that. I think my perspective is Jim's standing up for the American people against this town, basically, and saying we need to change this place. So, you know, people aren't looking for him to be, you know, cutting deals. I think getting people to understand how you approach things, that's a different thing, right? I mean, how you approach the spending process, how you approach the CR appropriation fight, how you approach Ukraine funding, how you approach the border. I mean, I think explaining those things makes sense, but, you know, deal cutting, no.
You don't think 16 votes is insurmountable?
Nothing's insurmountable, right? I mean, it's a matter of working with people, trying to figure out what you can do.
How many rounds should he go before you find a different nominee?
I mean, that's up to him. I mean, I'd certainly go for a while to go through the process. I mean, we had some debates. This is fairly open that we were trying to make some changes in the conference to see if we can go through some cycles there. The conference said they didn't want to do that, so now here we are, right? So we'll see where it goes.
Can you unify the party?
I think very much so. And I think, I mean, you're seeing that there. I mean, there's a lot of people there that if I had to ask you again 2 years ago, 4 years ago, this individual is going to vote for Jim Jordan for speaker, you might have said, no, I'm not sure about that. Jim's done a lot of work uniting the conference, and we're a pretty united conference on most of the issues and what we want to see get done. So we just got to work through this process.
But how do you change the votes of lawmakers who aren't opposed to Jordan because of policy, just because it's Jim Jordan and the faction of the...
I mean, you'd have to ask them and say, well, you know, why do you oppose Jim Jordan? Give me your reasons for why you're voting no, right? I mean, is it just because you're angry? That's not a message. I mean, so, you know, go to the American people and explain your vote. Explain who you're for. I look forward to all of my colleagues doing that, and we'll see that unfold over time. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Congressman.
Congressman Chip Roy, Republican from Texas, with reporters on the steps of the U.S. Capitol building after today's first House floor vote on electing a new speaker to replace Kevin McCarthy, Republican from California, who was ousted a couple of weeks ago. And the nominee from the Republican Party, Jim Jordan from Ohio, did not get the necessary support in order to be elected speaker. Democrat Steny Hoyer of Maryland also talking to reporters.
We have a House that has now been shut down by the extreme wing of their party 4 weeks now. Now, this is our first day of meeting, so we'll see where it goes. But that needs to stop. And the way it stops is for Republicans to decide that they want to go to a place where they can get votes, as opposed to going to places that they've lost votes. This, he got less than McCarthy got. We'll see what happens.
What does a consensus speaker, you know, look like, the logistics look like in real life? Like, would Democrats ever nominate someone other than Jeffries?
No, I don't think we have to nominate. We're going to nominate Jeffries. But we'll see what Mr. Jeffries says. But they have right now more votes than we do. They have more members than we do. But we need a speaker who's responsible, a speaker who has appreciation for the institution's role in our democracy and in making our government work and making America stable and confidence building rather than confidence destroying.
So in practice, if Republicans chose someone who met those standards, would Democrats just not show up for the vote and let that person become speaker? I guess I'm just curious what that would actually look like.
Well, there are a lot of different ways. One option is we vote for a speaker that we think will be responsible and effective. We have an acting speaker that I think wants to be responsible. So there are a lot of options available to us. But
would you support giving McHenry more power?
That's one option. I'm not going to choose my options at this point in time. But I want to choose an option that has the House of Representatives working on behalf of the American people. And providing some stability in our country and in providing the aid that Ukraine needs to fight despotism and destruction and international criminal law breaking, and our friends in Israel the same. And I think most members want the House to be working. I think most Republicans do, and all the Democrats do. And I would hope we would get to that end in a way that gives confidence that we can work together.
Congressman Steny Hoyer, Democrat from Maryland, a former majority leader, speaking to reporters on the steps of the U.S. Capitol after the first House vote to elect a speaker and no candidate getting the necessary majority to win. Reporters caught up with the Republican nominee for speaker, Jim Jordan, in the U.S. Capitol hallway late this afternoon. He said that he expected more votes on the House floor.
How many rounds do you think this speaker vote's going to take?
We need to get a bunch of jump, bunch of jump. We need to get a speaker as soon as possible. We need to work with the American people.
Any concerns you've heard from members about tactics used to win your vote?
No.
Are you going back to the floor today?
No. But that's the plan.
When do you think the next vote will be, sir?
Congressman Jim Jordan, Republican from Ohio, with reporters as he was walking and talking. That video posted by CNN. And later, we heard that there would be no further votes expected for a speaker on the House floor this Tuesday, and that the House would be meeting on Wednesday at 11 a.m. Eastern. And the first order of business would be a quorum call establishing that the members are present, and then they would proceed to a second ballot for the election of speaker. As always, gavel-to-gavel coverage of the House on C-SPAN television, and we will cover the speaker's race on the House floor here on C-SPAN Radio. Former President Donald Trump endorsed Congressman Jordan for speaker a couple of weeks ago when Jim Jordan was running against Congressman Steve Scalise for the House Republican Conference nomination. The first time around, Steve Scalise beat Jim Jordan for the nomination, but that never went to the full House for a vote when it became clear that Steve Scalise could not get an absolute majority of House members to be elected Speaker. And then the conference met again, and Jim Jordan got the nomination, this time beating Congressman Austin Scott of Georgia, and today lost the first vote on the House floor. Donald Trump, also a 2024 Republican presidential candidate, before today's House floor vote, expressed support again for Jim Jordan for Speaker.
Mr. President, did you call for the Speaker this weekend for Jim Jordan?
Yes. I think Jim will be Speaker of the House. He's a fantastic young man. He's pretty young still, and he's very strong. He has very proper opinions about our country. He loves our country. He wants to see it do well, and I think he's going to be confirmed sometime soon. As you know, many people have now supported him. 24 hours ago, they were supporting somebody else. There seems to be great unification. I think Jim Jordan will be a great speaker. I think he'll be, I think he's going to have the vote soon, if not today, over the next day or two. And I think he'll end up being a great speaker.
Former President Donald Trump, Republican presidential candidate. He was speaking today outside the courtroom in New York City. There wasn't a microphone in front of him. That's why it was a little hard to hear. He was there attending the civil fraud trial brought by a lawsuit from New York Attorney General Letitia James, $250 million sought. Axios reports that Donald Trump's planned appearance was originally set to coincide with the testimony by his former personal lawyer, Michael D. Cohen. But Michael Cohen, scheduled to begin his testimony as early as Tuesday, delayed it due to a pre-existing medical condition. He said he plans to testify at the earliest opportunity. The Axios article says that Michael Cohen testified to Congress in 2019 that Donald Trump inflated the value of his assets, which is at the core of the civil fraud trial. Donald Trump, in his remarks today, denying that those charges are true. Donald Trump also responding today to the limited gag order imposed in another trial he's facing. That is the criminal trial on allegations he illegally attempted to reverse his loss in the 2020 presidential election. The judge in that case, U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan, yesterday said that all parties in the case, Donald Trump included, are prohibited from publicly targeting special counsel Jack Smith, his staff, or her staff, the judge's staff, or any other court personnel, or the families of all those individuals, and from making statements about witnesses in the case. The Washington Post writes that Donald Trump can argue that this prosecution is politically motivated, the judge said, but he cannot disparage the prosecutor by calling him a thug or vilify and implicitly encourage violence against public servants who are simply doing their jobs. Here is Donald Trump again today in New York City.
And I have other trials for being railroaded. You saw yesterday where they take away my right to speak. I won't be able to speak like I'm speaking to you. And I'm not saying anything wrong. I'm saying the truth. I won't be able to do this with that trial because the judge, which of course we're appealing, because the judge said basically I don't have a right to speak. And I'm the number one candidate leading the Republicans by 55 or 60 points. That should be over. And leading Joe Biden and I'm being restricted. My speech has been taken away from me. I'm a candidate that's running for office, and I'm not allowed to speak. This is a railroading that's all coming out of the Department of Justice. It's all set up by Biden and his thugs that he's surrounded with to try and sneak out an election victory that he's not entitled to win because he's been the worst president in the history of our country.
Former President Donald Trump at the courthouse in New York City. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast on the C-SPAN Now mobile app and wherever you find your podcasts. This story from Reuters, U.S. President Joe Biden leaves on Tuesday on a whirlwind trip to Israel and Jordan to get an update on Israel's war aims in its looming battle with Hamas militants and stress the need to get humanitarian assistance to Gaza civilians. President Biden is expected to spend part of Wednesday in Tel Aviv for talks with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and other officials as Israel prepares a ground offensive aimed at eliminating Hamas militants in Gaza, who killed 1,300 people during a rampage through southern Israeli towns on October 7th. President Biden will then fly to Amman, Jordan, for talks about accelerating humanitarian assistance to Gaza. There, he'll meet with Jordan's King Abdullah, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, who has long been opposed to Hamas and whose organization exercises limited self-rule in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. That was reporting from Reuters. John Kirby, the White House Strategic Communications Coordinator for the National Security Council, was interviewed on ABC's Good Morning America about the aims of this trip.
Spell out the president's mission as he heads to the Middle East.
Really two things that are really primarily on his mind. First is making sure he gets an update from our Israeli counterparts about their plans, their intentions, how things are going on the ground, and make sure that he conveys a strong message of continued support for their Israeli defense forces and their ability to continue to prosecute these operations against Hamas. And number two, it's really on the humanitarian front, and he'll be hitting that not only hard while he's in Israel, but when he goes to Amman, Jordan, and speaks to President Sisi of Egypt, President Abbas of the Palestinian Authority, and of course King Abdullah, all focused on making sure that humanitarian assistance can flow in and that people who want to leave can get out. And obviously, he's going to be very focused on the hostage situation, particularly those few American hostages that we know are being held by Hamas.
This is a hot zone. How concerned are you for the president's safety?
Well, there's always a concern wherever the president travels for his safety, of course. This will be certainly no different, and I'm sure that the concerns will be appropriately addressed through the necessary force protection and personnel protection measures, but obviously we won't go into details about that.
You said the president wants to show support for Israel, but does his mission also include urging Israel to restrain themselves, not avoid a full-scale ground invasion of Gaza?
Well, look, we're not getting into dictating operational terms to the Israelis. They have every right to defend themselves and to prosecute Hamas. But that said, George, I mean, since almost the very, very beginning here, we have been talking about how important it is for democracies like Israel and the United States to stand up for the law of war, to respect innocent civilian life, unlike Hamas. So this is a foundational element of the discussions that we've had with the Israelis for forever, and we'll continue to do that going forward.
John Kirby is Strategic Communications Coordinator for the White House National Security Council, interviewed on ABC's Good Morning America. CNN reports while there was no explicit stipulation from the U.S. that Israel not launch its invasion until President Biden leaves the region, that's the understanding among American officials who have spent the past several days debating and planning the president's visit, according to multiple people familiar with the matter, and that American officials want humanitarian plans for Gaza fully signed off on and implemented before the start of the invasion, the people said, describing that task as among President Biden's main objectives during his visit to Tel Aviv on Wednesday. This from the New York Times, a story that Israel has asked the United States for $10 billion in emergency military aid, and that a package is moving forward in Congress in coordination with the White House and will also include funds for Ukraine, Taiwan, and the U.S.-Mexico border. U.S. Senate leaders talking about this. First, the Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York.
The task now is threefold. One, to eliminate the threat to Hamas, of Hamas. If Hamas is allowed to continue, the same thing will happen again. If you read the Hamas Convention and their history, they believe that there should be no Jews between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River. they would do to the rest of the Jews in Israel what they did to the Jews along the Gaza line. Second is to secure safe return of the hostages. And third is to remind Israel that she must be humanitarian, that she must obey the rule of war and must minimize civilian casualties among the Palestinians. And we did that to every leader we met. As majority leader, as the highest-ranking Jewish leader in American history, I felt I wanted to be there and I had to be there as an obligation. And now we're going to do everything in our power to ensure that the Senate delivers the support for Israel and the rescue package. We intend to get the package the end of this week, and it will include the military help Israel needs, the diplomatic and intelligence help Israel needs, as well as humanitarian aid to minimize the loss of innocent human life of Palestinians and of Israelis.
The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, at a news conference. The Senate Republican leaders held their own press conference, and Minority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky asked about aid to Israel.
Do you worry that including Ukraine in this Israel package could compromise the Israel portion given the opposition to Ukraine among the House Republicans?
Well, I think we have to address the problem that I outlined at the beginning. The most recent attack in Israel is part of a broader concern developed during the Ukraine war. Basically, the democracies of the world are all on the same side. You see the South Koreans, the Japanese, the Taiwanese concerned about Ukraine. The Prime Minister of Japan said at one point, if you want to send President Xi a message, beat Putin in Ukraine. This is all interconnected. You've got the North Koreans, the Iranians, the Russians, and the Chinese, sort of, on the same side against the democratic world. So there's a connection between all of this, and I'm not surprised, frankly, that the administration seems to be inclined to send up a broad package. And as my colleagues have pointed out, the border part of it needs to be credible, not just some reference to it, but a credible dealing with the problem that Senator Daines just pointed out.
That's the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, at a Senate Republican news conference in the U.S. Capitol building. A few articles from Associated Press about Israel's war with Hamas. One reads, a grisly montage of video and photographs of Hamas's massacre of hundreds of civilians across southern Israel last week highlights the savagery of the attack and the ease with which the militant group appeared to operate inside Israel. The footage that the Israeli military showed foreign correspondents Monday included a photo of a burnt baby. It showed gunmen shooting the dead bodies of civilians in cars, militants in the process of beheading a body with a hoe, burnt corpses thrown into a dumpster. Another article, Israel bombed areas of southern Gaza where it had told Palestinians to flee to ahead of an expected ground invasion, killing dozens of people on Tuesday in attacks it says are targeted at Hamas militants that rule the besieged territory, with no water, fuel, or food being delivered to Gaza since Hamas's brutal attack on Israel last week. Mediators struggled to break a deadlock over delivering supplies to increasingly desperate civilians, aid groups, and hospitals. Again, that from Associated Press. This morning in Washington at the historic 6th and I Synagogue, congressional leaders and Biden administration officials joined Jewish organization leaders in support of Israel. It was hosted by the Conference of Major American Jewish Organizations. Here's one of the speakers, the U.S. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, Democrat from New York.
10 days ago, we watched in horror and heartbreak as Hamas launched an unprovoked, calculated and barbaric attack against the state of Israel and the Jewish people. Hamas terrorists intentionally targeted and slaughtered Israelis in their homes, fired thousands of rockets at civilian areas, decimated entire communities, including neighborhoods, I have personally visited in Sderot or Kfar Azah and kidnapped women, children, young people, and seniors who are now being held in Gaza in harrowing conditions. Let me reiterate without hesitation that Hamas must be decisively defeated for the good of Israel, for the good of the Palestinian people, for the good of the region, and for the good of this world.
The House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, Democrat from New York, at the 6th and I Historic Synagogue in Washington, D.C., a program today in support of Israel. Also speaking there, the House Majority Leader Steve Scalise, Republican from Louisiana.
Well, let me say this clearly. Israel is at war, and America will stand united with Israel and her people's right to defend themselves from these barbaric attacks. We've seen the numbers. Over 1,400 people barbarically murdered, thousands more injured, hostages being held in Gaza, Americans included in those numbers. I've had some of my own colleagues going over to Israel just last week to help get people out. We all know people that are trying to help evacuate people. We've seen over 6,000 rockets fired at Israel. This war will not be easy. The Iran-backed Hamas terrorists who committed these atrocities spent not just weeks, but probably years planning this attack. Their attack struck deliberately at the most vulnerable. Young people at a music festival, elderly people, children, reports of beheadings, disabled. Israel holds itself to a higher standard. There can be no equivalence between the pure evil of Hamas and Israel's effort to defend itself against terror.
The House Majority Leader Steve Scalise, Republican from Louisiana. New poll from Rasmussen reports, this is their website, by a 26-point margin, more voters think the relationship between the United States and Israel has worsened under President Joe Biden. The latest Rasmussen Reports national telephone and online survey finds that 43% of likely U.S. voters believe America's relations with Israel have gotten worse since President Biden took office, virtually unchanged since July, while just 17% think the U.S.-Israel relationship has gotten better. 29% say U.S.-Israel relations are about the same. 11% are not sure. More from the 6th and I Synagogue program today in Washington. Eliab Benjamin is deputy Israeli ambassador to the United States.
Hamas is a barbaric terrorist organization worse than ISIS that incites violence and attacks civilians and takes its own people hostage. Since Saturday, Simchat Torah, October 7th, Hamas has fired and is continuing to fire over 6,900 rockets as of this morning into Israel, targeting homes, hospitals, and cities all across the country. Hamas fires these rockets from densely populated areas and buildings, including from within under schools, hospitals, and mosques, putting innocent civilians and children at risk. Israel continues to offer evacuation routes amid the consistent warnings to civilians about incoming rocket attacks. Israel is working hard to get innocent people out of harm's way, while Hamas is working hard to put people in harm's way. Hamas has been actively preventing its own population from leaving portions of the Gaza Strip. Indeed, Hamas is using its own Palestinian population as human shields. Let's be clear. Hamas terrorists are not freedom fighters who act to represent the aspirations and ambitions of the Palestinian people. Their fundamental goal is to annihilate the State of Israel and kill every Jewish man, woman, and child. My friends, Israel is at war. Israel did not choose to start this war, but Israel will end it. As we respond, the IDF, one of the world's most moral militaries, will act in accordance with international law and ethics. But make no mistake, like every other nation in the world, Israel has the right, and in fact a duty, to defend its citizens against the brutality of terrorism. We will ensure that Hamas war machine is eliminated. And to do that, we will not and we shall not apologize.
Eliav Benjamin, Deputy Israeli Ambassador to the United States at the historic 6th and I Synagogue in Washington, D.C. You can find the full program at our website at cspan.org, our video library. Also there today, congressional leaders, Biden administration officials, including the Homeland Security Secretary, and leaders of Jewish organizations such as the Anti-Defamation League. And then again, that's at cspan.org. The bipartisan leadership of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and of the House Foreign Affairs Committee have introduced resolutions in support of Israel and condemning Hamas. They are expected to pass the House and Senate. The House resolution, the sponsors say, has over 400 co-sponsors. Congresswoman Cori Bush, Democrat from Missouri, has introduced a different resolution, co-sponsored by about a dozen Democratic members, urging, quote, an immediate de-escalation and ceasefire in Israel and occupied Palestine. And the resolution goes on, all human life is precious, and the targeting of civilians, no matter their faith or ethnicity, is a violation of international humanitarian law. Congresswoman Cori Bush posted a video Monday night.
Over the past week, many of my constituents have called my office, leaving anguished voicemails, urging all of us in Congress to stop a humanitarian catastrophe in Palestine and Israel right now. One of the constituent voicemails that played over and over in my head is from a woman who said, quote, I'm calling as a Jewish person, even though I know it's probably futile. I urge you to continue to advocate for a ceasefire and to advocate for the lives of Gazans. She then began to weep and hung up in tears. Our empathy and solidarity cannot be conditional. It must be universal. This is why I'm so proud to be leading this resolution alongside my extraordinary and courageous colleagues today, because I promised to save lives, because I see the shared struggles between the people of Ferguson and the people of Palestine, between the people in St. Louis and the people in Israel, because I preach the notability of peace, because I'm against human rights violation wherever they occur, because I'm against state-sanctioned violence wherever it happens, because I want equality, justice, safety, and dignity for everyone, and because I have love for the Israeli and Palestinian people who are suffering because of this violence and the inability of our governments to resolve the root causes of systemic oppression, military occupation, and the crimes of apartheid.
Congresswoman Cori Bush, Democrat from Missouri, in a video posted Monday night, she is the main sponsor of a ceasefire resolution calling for ceasefire on both sides between the Israel and Hamas war. Story from the Wall Street Journal, Palestinian health officials said more than 500 people were killed in an Israeli airstrike on a Gaza hospital in one of the deadliest single incidents of violence in the Strip hours before President Biden was expected to visit Israel in a show of support. Wall Street Journal notes that the Israeli military, a spokesperson saying he is looking into what happened at the hospital. Later, there was this headline from the Times of Israel. Israeli Defense Forces say assessment shows that a failed Islamic Jihad rocket caused the Gaza hospital blast. There was a question about all this today at the Pentagon briefing in the United States with the Deputy Press Secretary, Sabrina Singh.
Talked about how, you know, what separates the U.S. and Israel from Hamas. Yeah. It's your democracies. You expect them to follow the rule of law. But Israel has a very long and well-documented history of targeting and killing civilians. We saw it earlier this morning when the UN said they killed five and now roughly 500 believed to be dead. I get the point you're trying to make, that is the expectation, but why not say, given your history, even though you are an ally, we will put in end-use monitoring systems, we will track you in the way that we track other countries. Why not put those guidelines in place, knowing what you know about them?
We feel confident in our discussions that the secretary has had with Mr. Gallant. You just saw Secretary Blinken was back in Israel for a second time in just less than a week. The president is going to Israel today. These are certainly things that will be discussed. But again, we did not put preconditions on Israel when it came to providing security assistance. We feel that Israel is and democracies like Israel and us should follow the law of war and will follow the law of war in protecting innocent civilians and directly targeting where these known terrorists are.
I guess they're not, is my point. And like, just because a command center is in a hospital, it's still a war crime to target those, right? So I guess what I'm saying is, like, there is evidence that they're not doing what you're saying they should be doing. Why not then say, okay, we will now put in the restrictions?
Well, again, in relation to the report that you're referring to, I've seen the reports. I don't have any more details to provide at this time. I don't know who is responsible. We don't have all the facts, and I'm sure as we learn more, that will inform conversations. But right now, I'm not going to go down a hypothetical road of who is responsible for something. What I can tell you again is what the secretary has been very clear on is that we expect Israel to uphold the law of war, and our priorities, our objectives in supporting Israel is making sure that Israel has what it needs through our security assistance, sending a continued strong message of deterrence that should any other actor think of entering the conflict, that they think again, and that we are being mindful and vigilant of any threats to our U.S. forces.
The Pentagon Deputy Press Secretary Sabrina Singh at her briefing at the Pentagon. And word now from the White House that President Biden's trip to Israel will include only Israel, and that originally he was going to go to Jordan, meeting with the leaders of Jordan, Egypt, and the Palestinian Authority, but that portion of the trip has been canceled. This is Washington Today. Also at the Pentagon briefing today was Assistant Secretary of Defense for Indo-Pacific Security Affairs, Eli Ratner, and the commander of U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, Navy Admiral John Aquilino. They were talking about U.S.-China relations, the Pentagon releasing its annual China Military Power Report, or CMPR. Assistant Secretary Ratner says this report shows that China is using increasingly aggressive behavior against U.S. surveillance.
Well, last year's CMPR noted that that PLA fighter jets were increasingly engaging in coercive and risky operational behavior. This year's CMPR provides a much clearer estimate of that disturbing trend. Specifically, since the fall of 2021, we have seen more than 180 such incidents, more in the past 2 years than in the decade before that. That's nearly 200 cases where PLA operators have performed reckless maneuvers or discharged chaff or shot off flares or approached too rapidly or too close to U.S. aircraft, all as part of trying to interfere with the ability of U.S. forces to operate safely in places where we and every country in the world have every right to be under international law. And when you take into account cases of coercive and risky PLA intercepts against other states, the number increases to nearly 300 cases against U.S., ally, and partner aircraft over the last 2 years.
Assistant Secretary of Defense for Indo-Pacific Security Affairs Eli Ratner at the Pentagon during a news conference. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky says that Ukraine's military has used the long-range missiles provided by the U.S. after President Biden agreed to supply them against Russian targets that were, up to this point, out of range, up to 200 miles away. President Zelensky, in a daily video message, saying, "Special thanks to the United States. Our agreements with President Biden are being fulfilled. They are being fulfilled precisely. ATACMS missiles have proved themselves." Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett is the latest justice to say she supports a code of conduct for the United States. USA Today writes that Justice Barrett's remarks come as the Supreme Court has been heavily criticized after a series of stories this year detailing lavish travel that Justice Clarence Thomas accepted from a Republican donor as well as revelations that Justice Samuelito flew to Alaska for a fishing trip on a private jet in 2008 that belonged to a hedge fund manager who repeatedly brought cases before the high court. Justice Barrett was interviewed Monday night in Minneapolis at a program organized by the University of Minnesota Law School.
I think it would be a good idea for us to do it, particularly so that we can communicate to the public exactly what it is that we're doing in a clearer way than perhaps we have been able to do so far. I will say this. There is no lack of consensus among the justices. There's unanimity among all nine justices that we should and do hold ourselves to the highest standards, highest ethical standards possible. So, I mean, I think what we are thinking about, you know, in thinking about what I think about in a code of conduct is how best to express what it is that we are already doing. You know, and we already abide by the statutes. There are a number of statutes that govern all judges, including justices. We all file our financial disclosure forms, for example, or by gift regulations. Those are statutory requirements. And then I personally, and this is true of my colleagues as well, still follow the same rules that applied to me when I was a Court of Appeals judge, the canons of conduct. There are some differences that apply to the court just by virtue of its position in the hierarchy of the judiciary. And I think, you know, we spend, our day job is, you know, reading statutes and seeing if Congress anticipated everything or communicated everything clearly. And so, you know, I think it's, we want to do a good job at that. So.
Do you think it will take much longer to come to an agreement about what a code might be, or what do you foresee looking ahead?
Well, let's see. I think that's something that I can't really speak for the court about or make any sort of guess about that. I would just say that one thing I would want all of you all to know is that all nine justices are very committed to the highest standards of ethical conduct. All nine justices, I mean, and we're in agreement about what to do, and that we want to continue to follow the highest ethical standards. So any disagreement is nothing to do with either of those principles.
Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett and University of Minnesota Law School professor and former dean Robert Stein in Minneapolis Monday night. KARE-TV reports that Justice Barrett's appearance was met with protests both outside and inside the auditorium. A group of a half dozen protesters in the second deck carrying signs referencing Justice Barrett's ruling on abortion shouted, "Not the court, not the state, people must decide their fate," before police escorted them out of the building. The lecture then continued without interruption. Student groups had collected online signatures in an attempt to disinvite Justice Barrett from campus. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Sign up for C-SPAN's free evening newsletter, Word for Word, to get the stories making headlines emailed to you every day. Subscribe at cspan.org/connect. Have a good night.